seconds. 4, 3, 2, 1. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Authority Smashing Hour with your hosts, Hootie Kim and Mr. 1001 Nights. Join us as we embark on a journey through radical news and politics, take callers, and get stewards to engage in the struggle against capitalism.
Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to the Authority Smashing Hour, your favorite anarchist show on the internet. And it is Tuesday, and we have as a guest every Tuesday, Joey. How you doing, Joey?
Hey, what's up, Jonathan? I'm doing good.
Yeah, so I guess there's, you know, believe it or not, we're doing this every day, and, you know, you would think that we would run out of news, but I find out that if you actually spend some time looking at the world's events, you can find out a lot of news that's going on all over the place. And so, first of all...
I want to send a shout-out to our listeners, too. So thanks for tuning in, y'all. And our number is 646-716-8106, if you want to call in. 646-716-8106.
Yes, and you can also write your questions on the chat room, and we'll try to follow that and see if we can answer your queries. And you can also call to make comments or eat whatever you want. So, well, I guess I may start on a personal note here. I was a little bit upset this morning because Well, you know, it's nothing too serious, but basically I went to the Democracy Now! Website, and, you know, I follow Democracy Now! Pretty closely, and they had their last sort of item. You know, they usually have like three, four items that they cover, and it was, they were interviewing the directors of a new documentary called By the People, The Election of Barack Obama, and... And these people, Charnchi did a little bit of a investigation on these people and the documentary. I mean, it was obvious, but it's basically they are advocates of the Democratic Party, and this whole thing is about how, you know, it was really a grassroots movement, a democratic movement that got Obama elected. And yet, I mean, they've given these people a slot in their program, you know, supposedly a radical program. And a few months ago, when I finished my documentary, Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Politics, which extensively talks about Barack Obama and the elections in 2008, as well as a broader look at the electoral process in industrial countries, particularly in the United States, I sent a DVD to Amy Goodman, and I said, you know, if you want to... You know, if you have any questions about it, if you would like to have me or Thomas Ferguson in the program, we can talk about this. It examines the elections, but instead, so they totally ignored me, and instead, they got these people, these liberals, talking about how democratic the Barack Obama election was. So I was a little disappointed. I mean, it's not that Democracy Now! Doesn't have good stuff, but it's just sometimes they just go too far to the sort of liberal side of the spectrum.
Well, I mean, you know, it's about, you know, building a name for yourself, a reputation, et cetera. I mean, I think the By the People documentary is the one that's sort of backed by, like, Edward Norton and other sort of big-name Hollywood people. So,
right. It's
understandable that Democracy Now! Would want to sort of, I guess, bump their ratings or whatever.
It's on HBO.
You know, integrating.
It's an HBO documentary. It's a corporate HBO
documentary. Yeah, right.
Already being disseminated and plugged in all kinds of outlets, you know, corporate outlets. Like, why would they need to actually do that? But, you know, I'm sure they're getting more money that way. You know, if you go toward the center of the spectrum, you're going to get more supporters.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, like, Democracy Now! Is sort of kind of constructed itself as a, you know, kind of like an NPR, you know, type of program. So that's the sort of tone they take, et cetera. But how did the interview go? I mean, were they, I could imagine Amy Goodman, who was the other person? Was it, what's his face? Juan Gonzalez, was that the other guy? Like, who was conducting the interview?
For whom?
For the by the people.
Oh, it was, I don't think it was Juan Gonzalez. Maybe it was. I don't know. I remember Amy Goodman, but she, the thing, I do think they're more radical than NPR. I mean, they're a little more critical, and they have good stuff.
For sure,
I'm not putting them down. But I'm saying that in some respects they've gotten more conservative. Like if you listen to the, you know, for this documentary and for the other one, I had to spend hundreds of hours browsing through all this stuff, and so I especially Democracy Now! Footage, and a lot of the earlier stuff, you know, they started in the 90s, they sounded more like, you know, pretty radical, and so they were sort of radical socialists. Yeah. So now they're sort of social democratic in many ways, which is fine. Yeah. But it's just sometimes that can have bad repercussions on in some respects. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, I think basically it's an attempt to go mainstream on their part, you know.
Right.
So,
right.
Whatever.
So, but they you know, some of the things that they reported were actually pretty accurate, and one thing I read that they were reporting as well was that something like half of U.S. children, there was a study that came out saying that half U.S. children will get food stamps. Says a new study has concluded that nearly half of U.S. children and 90% of black youngsters will be on food stamps at some point during childhood, which is a pretty shocking statistic, you think about it.
Yeah, it is, definitely. So half of children are going to be on food stamps?
Well, they're saying at some point during childhood, which, you know.
Oh, my God. That's unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's pretty crazy if you think about it that
well, I'm
what?
Yeah, I'm thinking about it myself, and we were on food stamps off and on when I was a kid. So I guess it's, you know, I guess it's possible. It's interesting.
Right, you know, and that sort of, you know, takes us back to the argument of, well, you know, wouldn't charity take care of all this stuff and, you know, these problems? And right, and, you know, we know perfectly well that a society that is that relies on materialism, that is actually based on pursuing selfish interest and maximizing wealth, is not going to produce enough charity to help those in need. So,
well, of course not. It's impossible.
Well, you of course have studied some, you know, prior systems, you know, feudalism in older periods, and those systems didn't quite have a welfare state, but of course they didn't have the sort of capitalist mode of production in which, you know, the workers were so desperately relying on wages. They had other, they were sort of like part of the land, like the serfs part of the land. So they had their own sort of little welfare system, but it's not what we would call a welfare state. Nevertheless, what was the role of charity in that system, you think?
I think it's pretty much analogous to what we have now. The difference is that the obligations between the classes at that time were different than they are now. So, I mean, greed is something that was, like, very much sort of looked down upon, far more than it is now. I mean, now it's just like a vapid trope to rail against somebody's greed when the system itself is built to exacerbate people's greed. So, I mean, I think that, you know, there was just sort of more social obligations, more social ties. Everybody was closer to you in your local community. So, like, I mean, you, like, really had a closer connection to the indigent in your community. And of course, you know, there was the sort of compulsion ideologically, you know, on the part of the church to sort of, you know, twist the arm of the rich to open their pocketbooks for charity, you know. So almsgiving is, you know, what they called it. But yeah, I mean, it was, you know, the analogous sort of structure to the welfare state. And in every bit as insufficient the welfare state is, that was also insufficient. Mostly because, again, you're talking about a fundamentally hierarchical society built on specific power dynamics of exploitation, et cetera. And, you know, just like we have now, it's the welfare state is ultimately insufficient for dealing with everybody's needs. Back then, the practice of almsgiving and a more sort of stringent and vibrant notion of charity also wasn't sufficient, mostly because the underlying systems themselves were corrupt.
I have to say, though, that the, you know, the role of the church is kind of pretty fascinating, and to see the evolution of it, and that, you know, I actually wrote a review for a book called Bright Sided, which was written by Barbara Ehrenreich about the modern so-called positive thinking movement, and I sort of concluded that it was sort of a modern day religion where people, you know, we have a more secular society than we used to, say, in the Middle Ages, and yet there is a need for a spiritual side to life, and there's a need to maybe, you know, compensate for the lack of solidarity, the lack of mutual aid in society, and churches and positive thinking movements sort of play that role. And there's an incredible money generated in those institutions. Yet, I don't know what the difference would be between, say, a modern day church and an old one of, you know, middle age church in terms of the amount of charity that they provide, the amount of community support. That's but you know, we do know that even though, as you said, they were forcing the hand of the elite, they could do so because they were also playing an important role in the hierarchical system, right? They were sort of the glue, ideological glue. So they sort of played the role of the state.
You know, when we say like they're forcing the hands of the elite, I mean, you know, we've got to be very ironic about that. But yeah, it is what it is, and it's sort of existed, you know, for 2,000 years. But it is interesting that there is this, I guess, burst in sort of a post, you know, post-Christian age, et cetera, post-religious age in the West, to replace, you know, those structures through like secular spiritual lies type of structures. And I mean, the nation state itself is the one that's, you know, the example par excellence. I mean, you know, it's like the state is built on, like, you know, these like very secular, you know, metaphysical, really, like, if we, I would say, like, theologically grounded.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's
notion.
Any,
and it's co-opted, you know.
Any
it's,
irrational authority.
It's like, that's one, so yeah.
I think ultimately, any sort of irrational authority, ultimately, the support, ideological sort of a framework is one based on irrational belief or faith. So that if it's not, you know, maybe identical to religion, it's something similar, because you have these beliefs that that are not founded on any sort of empirical knowledge, simply on self-fulfilling prophecies and other sort of like fallacies that are sort of you know, the system generates by itself in order to ideologically support its own you know, its own framework.
I don't know that we have to go down the sort of irrational path and all that sort of stuff. I mean, I think it's just enough to say that people sort of strive for some sort of spiritual, for lack of a better word, connection to other people and to the world. And, you know, sometimes, or lots of times, you know, that sort of, I guess, drive is exploited by the elites in the hierarchy. And, you know, that's the sort of thing you get. I think that, I think that, you know, there's lots, like, holding up empiricism as the, you know, only way of knowing things, et cetera, et cetera. Like, I'm not content to go down that line. And,
right,
and
right.
And it's something that talks about it as well. It's like, you know, whenever somebody asks, you know, Chomsky, well, how can we learn more about the human condition, et cetera? Chomsky's like, well, you're not going to find it in a science book. You might as well, you know, go to literature. If you
right,
wanna,
but
you know,
I think that's what I was referring to in the sense that you have all these intellectuals, all these schools of thought, that claim to have a sort of theoretical and empirical basis for these power structures. And when Chomsky and others have pointed out that, in fact, there's so little we know about human nature that for these people, these charlatans, right, to talk about how they actually know by science that these structures are somehow needed because of human nature, because whatever, that shows that they are relying on irrational faith, and that they covered up with all these supposed facts about human nature and about the world that
I mean, you know, one of my reticence about, like, you know, holding up empiricism and sort of the quote unquote enlightenment, it descends from you know, Frankfurt School type of theory. Like, if we look at, you know, Horkheimer and Adorno and the Dialectic of the Enlightenment, which is an old classic. I mean, they go into the sort of mysticism involved that is sort of underlying this sort of virtually like cult-like enlightenment type of mindsets. You know, it's not to disparage enlightenment in any sense. It's just, I mean, you know, we just got to be realistic and critical of everything.
Well, I guess talking about being realistic, that there was something that a GOP lawmaker said that I sort of agreed with. Of course, if you interpreted the right way, he said, GOP lawmaker, healthcare bill is greater threat to the United States than terrorists. So I actually, if you interpret that in the right way, you'll see that he's actually right. The U.S. elite is probably more threatened by the you know, universal health care than they would be, or even a public option, than they would be by this supposed terrorist, right? So that's actually totally true if you actually reinterpret what he said.
Well, definitely, especially when we consider the fact that that much of the quote-unquote terrorist threat is like fabricated,
right?
And you know, not anywhere near the threat that it, and or not anywhere near the threat that it's made out to be. Then yeah, I mean, it's just a sort of basic observation that they're going to be more threatened by something that is real.
So we have a caller on the line.
Something that is generally fake.
We have a caller on the
line,
so I guess we can see who this is. Hello there. Someone there?
Hey, guys.
Hi, hey. What's your name?
Hey, can you hear me? My name's Chris.
Chris. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show. Thanks for calling in.
Hey. Yeah, thanks a lot. I kind of a strange question. I was, I'm actually a book publisher, and we just published a book which kind of related to your themes, and I was wondering if I could send you guys a free copy. And if so, just wondering what the best way to get in touch with you is, just to, if you like it. Obviously, I'd encourage you to talk about it, but is there a good way to get in touch with you about something like that?
The best way to get in touch with us would be through our blog.
Okay.
And the blog is, let me pull it up. And this goes for, you know, everybody. It's authoritysmashers.wordpress.com.
All right.
Yeah, and you'll be able to get in touch with us, you know, through that blog. That's probably the best way to do it.
Cool. All right, yeah. Well, thanks for taking my call.
Yep, no sweat. Thanks for calling, Chris.
All right.
Thanks.
Well, I guess he didn't want to elaborate on that book.
That's fine. I mean, you know, we'll see what he hooks us up with.
Right.
I'm down with that.
So we guess we continue on the path of trying to figure out how we got here and how we're gonna get out of this trap that we are in, and that's the a world that's being destroyed. I mean, yesterday we were talking about the Kilimanjaro mountains being melted away, and you know, we had this caller who was totally against believing any of the things that we were talking about. And yeah, so you know, it's tough, and it's anyone's guess if we're really gonna make it in this world. So,
I mean, I think that my perspective, I guess, going off of you and David's conversation, linking it to today. If I can get my two cents in about it. I think that the guy who called Tony actually made an interesting point about the fact that, you know, our knowledge of the situation is necessarily sort of limited, okay? And we have scientific consensus about global climate change. But the question is always going to be sort of, what do we do about it? And I think that lots of times we have to be cautious, okay? We, meaning anarchists, radicals, real radicals, have to be cautious about throwing our support behind liberals who are going to basically manage this crisis into into a way of substantiating and keeping the capitalist system rolling and going strong, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, lots like Al Gore is a perfect example of this, and other people in the sort of mainstream green movement.
Greenwashers.
Like, here's a dude like making millions upon millions of dollars. Okay. Basically off of managing this climate crisis. And it's like okay, well,
no, but,
that's cool,
but that's
all,
what it's all
but,
about.
But you're not, exactly. But see, the thing is that, I mean, we got to be careful who we throw our sort of allegiance behind. If climate change is real, okay, which, I mean, we have no reason to doubt it, it's not, okay? I mean, hell, the climate has naturally been changing for eons, et cetera, just like the guy was calling about yesterday. So, I mean, you know, if the climate's changing, then what is our responsibility? And, you know, these are conversations that are necessary. But these are conversations that are especially necessary for a capitalism in crisis, because the greatest thing that capitalism can have is yet another crisis to manage our lives, okay, and sort of, you know, utilize its market technology to sort of control people's productivity and direct what we do with our lives. And yeah. And that's one of the conundrums that we're in. Yes, you know, we should be concerned about the environment, et cetera, but, you know, we've still got to always keep our eyes on the prize, and that is, you know, eliminating, mitigating the effects of capitalism itself, and, you know, the current green, you know, mainstream capitalist movement, okay, doesn't redress any of the fundamental problems of capitalism. In fact, it exploits whatever climate crisis there is, okay, in order to substantiate the very systems, okay, that continue to bleed us all dry of, you know, energy, motivation, our own wealth, et cetera, et cetera.
I think I saw a book at Borders, like, earlier this year, and it was called something like How to Go Green and Get Rich in the Process. So, I mean, that's what it's
exactly
about, because the whole thing is about the onus is placed on the consumer, saying, you know, it's the consumer who has to choose these green technologies, and it's all in the context of getting rich. So you get rich or you make money through a business that goes quote unquote green, but once again, see, it's the market mechanisms that decide, and it's not the workers that get together and say we're going to produce this and produce that. It's that the capitalist who's concerned mainly with making money, concerned mainly with maximizing profit if you're a corporation for the stockholders, they pursue these green technologies as a profit-seeking sort of mechanism, but it's not that is not the, you know, the core of their functioning. That's not the reason why they're in business. They're not in business to give out to, you know, make the planet a sustainable place. They're in business to make money, and maybe if the market sort of allows them to make money that way, then have green technology. But see, the whole framework is so skewed, because that basically says, well, if we can't make money doing that, then we'll do something else. I mean, that's just, and so those who say, well, if the consumers want a sustainable world, they will choose to consume this and that, you know. But the fact of the matter, there's so many other factors that I was having this discussion the other day with someone on YouTube, and I told them only when the workers control the means of production, only when they actually get to collectively decide what to produce, how to produce it, all those things, then you start to see real human will, real human voluntary decision making, because the consumer system doesn't reflect that.
Yeah, I think and I've been very much sort of engaged in this strain of recent-ish anarchist thought. The insurrectionary anarchists have a really interesting sort of critique on green capital and the sort of environmental movement. If you read something like The Coming Insurrection, they have a whole sort of little chapter section or whatever basically on environmentalism as, you know, more sort of management, the sustaining of capitalism, et cetera, et cetera. But even more than that, I mean, if we sort of look through, I guess, the prism even more deeply, we can see that capitalism operates by these management, at least late global capitalism operates by these infinite sort of managements of like individual economic crises, you know, state crises like war, scientific crises like climate. So its job is to manage and manage those type of crises. And in so doing, it, you know, unleashes mechanisms of control, et cetera. But lots of the reasons that it's able to do that is based upon what you were saying before, the consumer. And it operates on the consumer via very sort of bizarre notions of guilt, okay? Like, oh my gosh, we are consuming X, Y, and Z. What am I supposed to do to sort of cleanse myself of the sin of eating a hamburger? Oh, well, what do I do? Well, I go down to the farmer's market the next day and buy some local produce, et cetera. I mean, I'm not saying it's bad to go to the farmer's market. I'm saying that the psychological impact, okay, of capital and how it trains us mentally okay, is, you know, very much turns on axes of, like, consumer guilt, okay? And that guilt causes us to consume more, which puts us back into the loop, and sustains it, you know, at even more fundamental levels.
You know,
so, like, something like tap and trade is a perfect example of this.
Don't you see sort of a similarity?
Like,
yeah, go ahead.
I'm just positing, I mean, cap and trade as a policy that's basically like selling indulgences to, you know, capitalists to expunge them of their guilt of, you know, spewing nonsense and evil poison into the atmosphere, et cetera. I mean, that's what it is. It's a market mechanism, okay? Hence, it's still going to substantiate the market, which is the fundamental reason why all these exploitations happen anyway. But it's built as a sort of guilt system, okay, of like, you know, sort of cleansing yourself of the dirtiness of capital by staying within the warm embrace of capital itself.
Don't you see some similarities with, for example, the diet food movement, you know, because I as a former ballet dancer, you know, when I was dancing, I remember all these foods that I saw people eating, and of course, people that are fat eat these foods too. But Diet Coke, you know, yogurt that's fat-free, yogurt that has aspartame, all these. So you buy donuts and says, well, you know, 1/3 less calories. So you're basically, instead of just having a natural process where you eat if you're hungry and you're counting. You have this quantitative approach where you're counting the calories. Well, you know, I can eat three of these yogurts because, after all, they only have so many calories. I mean, the whole thing is so sick, and of course, it doesn't work. We have an increasingly obese population, so this stuff is not working at all. But there's a sort of similarity between the marketing strategies of the green movement, the green washing movement, and the diet movement, don't you think?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, the whole idea behind what you're talking about with the yogurt is that you can still go on consuming at a ridiculous pace, you know? You can just feel better about it. You know, it's like, oh, it's okay because, you know, this thing's only 50 calories. So, okay, well, hell, you know, a Big Mac is, I don't know what the fuck it is, like, what, 800 calories or some nonsense? Well,
yes.
You know, if I have 10 yogurts over the course of a day, hey, I'm doing good. But you're still consuming out the ass, right? You know, and that's the sort of, you know, loop, I mean, that we get into. You know, it's still, you know, built on obscene notions of, you know, consumption and, you know, and production, which leads to, okay, mass systemic exploitation, you know, here and definitely across the world.
Anyway, so everybody, we're going to take a little music break now. It's about 35 minutes into the show. When we come back, we're going to take some calls. And once again, the guest call-in number is 646-716-8106. Once again, 646-716-8106. So, see you in a little bit. Bye.
A Ballad of American Skeletons, or American Ballad of Skeletons. Said the presidential skeleton, "I won't sign the bill." Said the speaker skeleton, "Yes, you will." Said the representative skeleton, "I object." Said the Supreme Court skeleton, "What do you expect?" Said the military skeleton, "Buy star bombs." Said the upper class skeleton, "Starve unmarried moms." Said the Yahoo skeleton, "Stop dirty art." Said the right wing skeleton, "Forget about your heart." the Gnostic skeleton. The human form's divine, said the moral majority skeleton. No, it's not, it's mine, said the Buddha skeleton. Compassion is wealth, said the corporate skeleton. It's bad for your health, said the old Christ skeleton. Care for the poor, said the Son of God skeleton. AIDS needs cure, said the homophobe skeleton. Gay folks suck, said the heritage policy skeleton. Blacks are out of luck. Said the macho skeleton, women in their place. Said the fundamentalist skeleton, increase the human race. Said the right to life skeleton, fetus has a soul. Said the pro-choice skeleton, shove it up your hole. Said the downside skeleton, robots got my job. Said the tough on crime skeleton, tear gas the mob. Said the governor's skeleton, cut school lunch. Said the mayor's skeleton, eat the budget crunch. Said the neocon skeleton, free markets the way. Said the savings and loan skeleton, make the state pay. Said the Chrysler skeleton, pay for you and me. Said the nuke power skeleton, and me and me and me.
So that was Ballad of Skeletons with Allen Ginsberg and Paul McCartney. Welcome back to the Authority Smashing Hour, your favorite show on the internet from the anarchist perspective that you don't hear in the corporate media. And the guest call-in number, once again, is 646-716-8106. And we take your calls, your comments, or whatever you feel like saying. So you there, Joey?
Yep, I'm here.
So I guess we could talk a little bit about, I heard that some craft food workers in Argentina occupied a factory and had to do with some regulations that the government had passed related to the swine flu, so they wanted to close the factory, and they didn't want to, so... But there's been a tradition in Argentina of occupied factories, hasn't there?
Oh, definitely. It's been going on since the IMF screwed over that country and basically knocked it into the Stone Age at the beginning of the 2000s.
Right. There was a pretty bad economic crisis, what was it, like maybe about 10 years ago, right, in Argentina?
Yep.
And I remember, you know, because I was still, you know, still watching TV back then, and I saw, people just rioting, breaking into supermarkets, stealing food and so on. So it was, they had a huge rate of inflation, and it was pretty disastrous. And I think when I went to see Michael Albert speak, I think he was talking about some of his experiences talking to the Argentine factory workers, because he said that some of these factories that were taken over, they had self-management, but they still had some problems. Like Michael Albert was saying that because they were not sharing some of the tasks. Like, for example, some people were sort of just doing road work, and other people were doing more empowering work. That somehow that led to class differences between within the factory. So, that was a sort of valid point, I think, that he made, that sharing some of these tasks actually can lead to a more balanced situation where everyone sort of gets equal degrees of empowering work. Have you actually heard Michael Albert talking about this?
Yeah, I have a little bit, and I think, I don't remember exactly which lecture it was, but... I think he's talked also about, I feel so bad putting words in people's mouths, but something along the lines of the fact that this sort of like worker self-management, these types of things that occur in Argentina, in the Faustine Pa movement. They're going to move through very sort of herky-jerky experimental type of things. I mean, nobody ever said that, you know, this would be easy. It would be free of problems, et cetera. I mean, once we get rid of bosses, okay, you know, that doesn't mean that all of our problems are gone.
Right.
It just means we've got rid of bosses, okay?
Because so, the state is in our minds as well. That's I think that's important to note that you know, people say, hey, you know, if we just got rid of the elites, we got rid of the capitalists, we got rid of the leaders in our system. The problem is that the very reason why they are in power has to do with the fact that the masses, that the people, have an authoritarian, they have a hierarchical mentality. The state is in their minds. So it's not just about getting rid of the state, the actual physical state, but getting rid of the state in our own minds. And that's something that,
sure,
you know, we all have it. We anarchists have a state in our minds. We have this authoritarian, and that's because we are also the products of our collective environment. And so we can never get rid of that completely unless we are in a collective situation where people around us sort of exude this new liberated personality. I think that's something we have to understand.
Yeah, I think it's generally true or right, at least on some level, that, you know, the first anarchists aren't going to be us floating around today calling ourselves anarchists, but we can set in motion the institutions and the systems, you know, more basically, I guess, to facilitate later generations and other people, okay, and their ability to sort of, you know, have a non-statist, non-hierarchical mindset, which is exactly what something like the Faustine Pa movement has the potential to do. And so, I mean, you know,
which movement is this? Which movement is this?
The what? Movement? The Faustine Pa.
Can you talk about them a little?
Well, it's the one that, you know, sort of it's basically based around, like, the Zenon factory in Argentina. It's fabrica sin patrones. So
yes, without bosses.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the sort of name given to the general movement, but it's, you know, connected and linked to Zenon, the ceramic factory in Argentina, or at least, you know, it was named Zenon. Now it's, you know, Faustine Pa. But yeah, I mean, you know, these types of things aren't going to be perfect. You know, they're not going to unfold perfectly. And, you know, this is why it's important to have people who have expertise in sort of organizing and economics, et cetera, or in politics itself, to help workers along the path of, like, you know, setting up a system that can facilitate a more efficient, non-hierarchical running of a factory, for instance. That's why someone like Michael Albert, Chomsky, et cetera, they're important because, they can lend insight to, you know, the spontaneous sort of mass movement from, you know, their position as academics, et cetera.
Right, right. And I think in that regard, it's important to understand what the role of the intellectual is in sort of an anarchist system, and that is that they are mind workers. They utilize their mind just as somebody else utilizes a hammer or a you know, whatever it is.
Exactly.
It's not that we you know, that an intellectual, who happens to have a powerful mind or happens to understand certain things well, that person is supposed to be above in a hierarchical system everyone else. No, that person simply contributes and is, you know, using, instead of a hammer, you may be using, you know, whatever it is, a stick to, you know, you may have a different expertise, but that doesn't mean you're up in the hierarchy. But because, I mean, it's just inevitable that an industrial society will have specialists, we have people who have better knowledge of certain aspects of that society. That doesn't mean that we need to sort of put the intellectuals in a sort of pedestal and pretend that they're somehow superior human beings or whatnot. They are intellectual workers, and that's what they should be considered. And unfortunately, we don't have that point of view, particularly in Europe. In Europe, I think a lot of the intellectuals are considered to be, you know, these sort of like deities. The United States perhaps has a more healthy a point of view as far as that goes, because intellectuals are not respected, or at least they're not put in the same sort of status as European intellectuals. Is that your experience as well?
Well, I think so, but I mean, I think the pendulum swings in the U.S., you know, toward a sort of knee-jerk reactionary anti-intellectualism as well. So, I mean, you know, we've got the other side of that spectrum. I don't know that it's necessarily healthy.
Right,
you know,
right.
What we have. But it is different, I guess, than maybe what you'd find in Europe. And I mean, there are some, once you get into school, like once you're in the university, like, you know, professors will have, you know, their sort of groupies, or, you know, even in the U.S., I mean, they're essentially groupies, like fans, basically. Students as fans, you know, and I have no shame in saying that I'm one of them for some of my teachers, but you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, so, well, I guess in some way, I mean, you have a powerful minds like Chomsky, which have influenced thousands of people. So we're sort of his groupies in a way, you know, and we've all learned from him, and I'm sure he learned from other people, but I think, you know, it's about learning and then developing your own sort of perspectives based on what you've learned from other people. And, you know, so I think it's a combination of trying to, you know, undermine the ideology of the system, and then small actions such as, you know, I'm reading right now on the news, these small successes, you know, in the Israel-Palestine conflict, and they're reporting how, you know, these protests with the, you know, anarchists against the wall, they are sort of they're leading a lot of these movements. They're sort of the driving force behind a lot of these movements for liberation, and they're actually having some effects. It's not, you know, it's a pretty brutal place. You know, I mean, people get killed all the time. But if you guys go to infoshop.org and read this, I guess I can post it on the chat room. But the the people there are actually making some improvements. They're actually, it's not totally hopeless. And you know, a lot of people have talked about the nonviolent movement in Palestine has real potential. Finkelstein has actually said that that's the way forward, because the Israeli government actually wants violence. They want to have an enemy, and they're afraid of what is called the threat of peace. Because if you have somebody that's supposedly your enemy, who's not willing to engage in that sort of game anymore, then how do you justify your status as occupier? How do you justify your status as aggressor? Because as we know, every state likes to portray their actions as being defensive. So, yeah, these are things that actually can have some effect.
I mean, as far as that goes, I think there was a recent report, I think by Goldstein, that came out that's causing a huge...
The Goldstein report. The Goldstein report?
Yeah, exactly. That's causing a huge backlash within the Jewish community. I mean, the Anti-Defamation League sort of like, you know, how could you do this to us type of thing? And basically he was trying to give a... an honest account of what's happened in Gaza.
Well, we actually spoke about that. You know, in the other show, you know, what happened was really funny. I mean, there's a for those of you guys who are interested in knowing the details about this, go to Democracy Now! And type Finkelstein, because they had a Zionist there talking about how, you know, this is, I mean, they always say the same thing. Well, this is so anti-Semitic and all these things. And it turns out that the guy that they picked for to write this report, Goldstone, he's a total Zionist. This guy works in the University of Jerusalem. And what happened was that, you know, he was assigned to investigate Israeli crimes, war crimes, and he said, "No, I'm not going to do that. Says I'll only do it if you let me investigate Palestinian atrocities as well, right?" So they said, "Okay, you want to do that? Fine." Now, the reason why they actually commissioned him to do the job is because they knew that, since he's such a staunch Zionist and he works in Jerusalem, that. You know, the Israelis could not so easily dismiss the report and say, "Well, this is biased, somebody who's against Israel." This guy is as pro-Israel, as Zionist as you can get, and yet this guy came out with a report. I mean, he couldn't be so dishonest so as to say, "Well, he investigated and said, "Look, yeah, atrocities were committed on both sides, but of course." That's how the New York Times reported it, that it was both sides committing atrocities, but Israel obviously committing most of them, the bulk of them, which is a natural reflection of their power. They have much more power and means of violence than the Palestinians. But yeah, see, any criticism of Israel is going to be met with the sort of with the standard rhetorical tricks about anti-Semitism, references to the Holocaust, et cetera, et cetera. Pretty unfortunate, really.
It's the same old song and dance, man.
That's right.
The more things, I mean, you know, basically, like Congress, you know, condemned the Goldstein report. I mean, it's such a joke. Yeah, it's just something like, you know, it's perpetual.
Right, and well, I guess that's. On the other, the battle for intellectual fighting against the intellectual indoctrination, another part of it is some of the current battles for education. I mean, they're increasing tuition fees all over the place. And I think in the UK, there was just some recent battles between the students and the administration. Because, and I mean, this is happening everywhere. In San Francisco, where I live, they're trying to increase tuition fees, and you know, and it's, you know, it's pretty straightforward why this is happening. It's class warfare. They're trying to say, look, we need people who are not going to be skilled, and I guess another thing that I think could be also the case is that there's this pressure on the part of people who are educated to not have so much competition. I know that, for example, some of the liberal economists, like in CEPR, like Dean Baker, and they always talk about how some of the specialists, like doctors and engineers, that they're not in favor of say some of these policies that allow foreign doctors or foreign engineers from Russia, France, or wherever to come to the United States and compete with them. So globalization works. Corporate globalization works in that lower skilled workers are pitted against each other because they don't have any power. They can't do anything about it unless they form a union or something. But doctors, on the other hand, and engineers, people who are more skilled, they want to protect themselves against this sort of corporate globalization pitting one against the other. Do you see that happening as well?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's you know, typical of the bourgeois to protect themselves, okay, from the ravages of their own freaking system, and leave right. Everybody else to scrap amongst themselves. It's not, you know... That's not surprising to me at all. I mean, once you sort of move a little bit down the scale and get into the petty bourgeois, then things get a little more interesting, or they can anyways, but everybody knows that, you know, nothing goes on there. But yeah, I mean, it's typical. I mean, it's their system, so they're going to protect themselves and, you know, say screw you to everybody else. So,
you know. Another thing that I thought was interesting, someone sent me a letter, and this person was self-employed, you know, and I always talk about being self-employed, and he said, you know, I agree with your analysis, you know, about wage slavery and all that stuff, but I'm self-employed, and you know, it's still in the sort of broad framework of what I do, I'm still subordinated to some of these agencies. This was an English teacher who teaches ESL, basically English as a second language.
Sure, yeah.
And he says, I'm subordinated to some of these agencies, even though I'm self-employed. It's you know, it's really tough. And you know, I sort of felt sort of in the same way when I did this documentary, because I mean, I'm not Michael Moore, and, you know, obviously, I don't have, you know, neither the skill nor the experience nor the marketing sort of expertise there, but I got practically no help to do the documentary. I did everything by myself. I got a little help for the recording sessions with Ferguson, but I'm saying that the editing, DVDs, music, all those things, and so since I was the sole sort of a creator, I thought, well, I'm a sort of self-employed agent here, and maybe I'll make a few thousand bucks out of this. So I mean, and I haven't. I mean, I've made a few hundred bucks. So the question here is, if you can do a documentary that is, you know, halfway decent, you know, and all by yourself, where you don't even have to share the profits with anyone else, and you still can't make it in our system, you know, what does that say about, you know, being a self-reliant, self-employed individual? It's extremely hard.
Yeah. And not only that, but, like, just obvious stuff. Being able to do that, to start, I guess, your own business, you know, whatever, requires all sorts of different things. I mean, it requires deferred consumption or inheritance or thievery to even be able to, you know, to even be able to try to do
right,
a project, you know, like that, or et cetera. I mean, it's you know.
I may point out that, you know, like, one of the classical defenses of neoclassical economics is that they claim that people who get rich, they do it because of deferred consumption. But let's face it, if a woman has to give up, you know, food for, you know, for his child to open her own business, you can't compare that with some entrepreneur, some wealthy owner who has to give up his 10th Rolls Royce to upgrade some machinery in his factory. Yet in capitalism, yeah, these two deferments of consumption are sort of equated. But the fact of the matter is that most wealth was not started by deferment of consumption. It was started by historical processes such as colonialism, imperialism, theft of land, and then profit begetting more profit through the exploitation of labor and the sometimes transferable accumulations of wealth. That's what it is.
Yeah, definitely. We're closing in on the end of the show here, John, so maybe we should just sort of cut it off and pick up with some other stuff next week.
Right. If you want, we have a caller. Do you think we should take a caller? We have a minute left.
Yeah, let's take a caller then. I guess.
Okay, we'll take a caller before we close up. Hello? Someone there?
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Hey.
I wanted to ask the guy that did the documentary, what kind of marketing did you
90 seconds.
What kind of marketing? Well, I call these magazines to try to get a review, and no one has actually agreed. I put it on the internet, and I asked some people to give me some blurbs, and I got a few blurbs, but, you know, nothing really like paying for ads or anything like that.
That's why you failed.
Well,
60 seconds.
I did actually got Zenit to put up an ad, but yeah, I mean, that's the name of the game. That you know, people who say
exactly.
Michael Moore
wasn't Michael Moore until he broke the barrier. Now
right.
Maybe if you went back, perhaps, and try to find out what he did at the very beginning, that might help.
Right.
You can't do things in a vacuum. If you're, marketing is the name of the game for any type of business. If you don't know how to really go, and it takes a lot of work.
Yeah, I'm sure. So it's not just enough to have a product, a good product, is that, you know, you got to market it. And that sort of speaks, I think marketing really undermines the market system as it is defined in economics courses, because, you know, if advertising is such a big element.
Cut off, Jonathan. That's like a huge issue. Caller,
right.
Can you maybe call back next week or maybe tomorrow's show, because this is a huge issue having to do with marketing and its role sort of in, you know, pure market economics.
Right.
We're going to get cut off, and like, that's like a huge,
right,
like, very important topic, I think, that you raised, caller.
So thanks for calling, I guess we have to close it up. So are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, so we're going to close it up, and thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow. All right, well, good night,
every
man.
Every night of the week, 8 o'clock Eastern.
Okay. The world is waking.